Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
If VR becomes mainstream, I won't ever play a game on a monitor again because it is just that unreal and it's just that awesome.
More about how roleplay is being advanced with virtual reality later on in the show. Welcome to Text Message. I'm Nate Langson. First, some news. And joining me, Mr. Ian Morris, venerable regular co-host and journalist.
Hello.
According to Victoria Ward, writing on The Telegraph this week, Wimbledon spectators have been warned not to record the tennis on their mobile phones amid concerns about broadcasting rights to the hugely lucrative event. The All England Lawn Tennis Club has also banned selfie sticks, or what I like to call elongated ego rods, which extend to up to about 40 inches and have a smartphone perched on the edge. Now, the sticks are apparently considered a nuisance, and I'm still quoting here from The Telegraph, as well as being a potential weapon, could interfere with spectators' enjoyment. Now, I do take issue with the idea of selfie sticks being considered a weapon, but it did give us consideration to talk about Periscope, and apparently the AELTC, that's the All England Lawn Tennis Club acronym, insisted that the guidance concerning live streaming apps such as Periscope was simply an extension of the usual rule that mobile phones must be switched off, quote, in and around the courts in play. So I put it to you, Ian, is the AELTC fair in its ban, or at least its proposed ban, on the likes of Periscope and live streaming in the British sport?
Well, it just feels like a complete waste of time, doesn't it? Because no matter how much you ban it, you're never going to stop people from doing it, are you, really? And I have no sympathy for anyone involved in this, really. I have no sympathy for people at the All England Lawn Tennis Association, or whatever they're called, because I think it's a ridiculous rule to impose. But I also have no time for people who sit at events, be they tennis matches or concerts, and watch the whole thing through their phone screen. I just think, you've paid all that money to go, what the hell is wrong with you? Watch the damn thing. Enjoy the experience
of
it.
I mean, it's fair to say, I think, that in this modern age, things do not exist and have not ever existed unless they have been recorded on a phone. Unless you can tell somebody on Facebook in visual terms that you have done something, you may as well not have done it.
Well, that's an interesting take. I personally don't live like that, but then I'm old, so maybe the youngsters do feel that way. There's a lot of stuff I don't have a record of. You know, I don't, you know, take a picture of a lot of things. I don't take a picture when I go to a toilet, or, you know,
there is an app for that, you know.
People generally,
yeah,
is there? People generally don't document most of, no, that's not true, is it? Most people do document most of their meals, but at the same time, you know, what's a short stream on Periscope going to do for anyone? I mean, you've seen this sort of stuff that turns up on Periscope. It's hardly high quality, is it? It's a, what does it matter if someone streams 10 minutes of a match, an exciting 10 minutes? You know, it's just not a problem. It's on TV at that precise minute anyway.
The question I pose to you before we leave this topic in the ground here, Ian, is whether you think that there is a genuine risk to a broadcaster posed by Periscope, or for that matter, any other live streaming video platform?
No.
As simple as that.
Yeah, because the quality's rubbish. It's a tiny little video stream, you know, shot by an idiot with no ability to keep the camera still. Possibly it's a portrait video, which I don't want to watch, or a square. You know, I mean, we spent years coming up with HD and making it look amazing. The last thing I want to do is look at a weird little square of video on a phone. I mean, Periscope is hilarious at the best of times. I don't think I've ever managed to see a Periscope happen. People, you know, tweet, oh, we're doing a Periscope now. And by the time I've got on it, it's finished. I know you can rewatch them now, but even so, the thing is a joke. I just don't see it as any sort of a threat until people are rocking up at Wimbledon with a tripod, a broadcast camera, and some, you know, like amazing 5G streaming tech that's able to put it online at 4K. This isn't a threat to anyone, is it? It's just people doing what people do. And if you go to one of these events and start streaming stuff and annoy people around you, well, you're an arsehat, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
But they're everywhere.
Maybe the likes of Periscope should be giving a backhand to the sponsors to cover the thing. Are we at breaking point, though? That is the question I pose for listeners. Do let us know what you think.
Podcast as well.
Podcast at what? Sorry. Podcast at natelangson.com. Let us know. Right, well, let's keep this news volley going. Let's talk about a story that was on wired.co.uk this week. Mayor of London, Mr. Boris Johnson, has said that minicab drivers may have to take a pared-back version of the knowledge test, which famously must be undertaken by the city's black taxi drivers, in order to operate in the capital. Quote, TfL are currently consulting on a proper geographical test, so you can't drive a minicab in London unless you know one end of the city from the other, Boris told an audience at the State of London debate. There will have to be basic geographical knowledge. There would have to be basic English, basic command of the English language. I don't think that's an unreasonable thing, do you? I think that is perfectly reasonable. Now, that is according to Katie Collins of Wired.co.uk, who is writing up this story. And of course, this relates to Uber, which is the bane of many taxi driver lives. And so I dragged her into the studio to ask her what is going on, what is Boris really proposing, and what does this mean for the capital's taxi system?
Well, what Boris says is wrong with Uber, I don't think is necessarily what he thinks deep down. What he's saying is wrong with Uber is, in fact, he's kind of insulted them and called them a brash internet American company coming over and disrupting the market in this country. And I don't necessarily think that that is what he genuinely believes. You know, a lot of American companies come over here and operate as do British companies abroad, and I don't necessarily think that that is the problem. But what he's essentially trying to do is appease the taxi drivers, the black taxi drivers in London, and make it seem like he is sympathizing with them. And I think there are ways that he could have done that which perhaps would have been more practical. And, you know, he doesn't necessarily need to tell them that he doesn't like Uber and doesn't like innovation and new business models coming in. I think what he should be telling them instead is that, rather than kind of trying to shift the blame onto new models, is that he should be encouraging TfL to innovate from within and to ensure that the black taxi drivers of London have got the power to compete in this kind of new economy that's sprung up around Uber and the minicab industry in general.
Let's talk a little bit about what Boris has suggested Uber should be doing, which is almost like a mini the knowledge test. Like, he seems to think that it is unfair that taxi drivers have to go through a very strict process of learning, you know, thousands of routes and street names and everything around London in order to get a black cab, whereas a company can come in and use technology to make that irrelevant and operate and still have the same experience as far as a customer's concerned. So what is it that he thinks Uber should be doing?
Well, this is quite an interesting one, because he says that what he's announced is that he would like Uber to take a knowledge-like test for all of its drivers. It would like to apply this to kind of as an entry test, as it were, to the minicab industry in London. What he's not doing is being very clear about what he actually means by that. So he, when pressed, he said, oh, they will have to show that they have a basic grasp of the English language, and they will have to show that they know more than left from right and this kind of thing. But at the same time, what he said is that it won't be the knowledge or an equivalent test to the knowledge, because he believes it's important that black taxi drivers exclusively have this in order to retain what makes them special, and to show that they have some kind of superiority, I guess, over Uber drivers and minicab drivers in the city. So what he's doing is sending out very mixed messages here.
Mixed messages coming from Boris Johnson. Shocker. I know what you mean, though. I think that it's a move that is relevant to us because, obviously, the black cab industry in London is, if not unique, it's certainly very special. And it has both an aesthetic appeal that is almost of value tourism-wise than anything else, kind of like the yellow cabs in New York. But the fact is that they are not, as we've talked about in this show and many other shows in the past, the problem is that they haven't innovated fast enough. But the industry does need to be supported. If it's going through a transition, there needs to be a support. This apparently is support. And at least with this one, it's not flat out, let's just ban Uber. Like, he's accepted we can't ban a company from coming in and doing something innovative, but maybe we could try and soften the blow. I mean, do you even think, just on the last point, do you think this is something that could work?
Well, it's interesting that you should say that, because what Boris has said about Uber is not that, you know, he doesn't want to ban them. He's said to the black taxi drivers of London, I can't ban them because they'll just come in and they'll overturn it, and within a day that will be irrelevant. So this is, like I said, this is a thing that he's doing to try and appease them. Whereas and rather than doing that, I think they would, Boris and TfL, if they want the black taxi drivers of London to remain an important part of London's transport infrastructure, which, you know, many would argue they is something that should happen, and they should be protected, their jobs should be protected, etc., is that they would invest that time rather than attempting to perhaps regulate the minicab industry more, is to reassess whether putting all this stock in the knowledge is really relevant in this day and age, when we have such, you know, we have tools like Google Maps. Perhaps the 4 years or whatever it is that they spend studying for the knowledge, perhaps that isn't necessary. Perhaps it would be more useful to do something else instead.
Is this basically the minicab equivalent of don't teach kids long division because they'll all have calculators anyway?
Some might say that it is, and I don't think that anyone would argue that having
good. I don't want anyone to argue with me.
Having that basic level of knowledge there, and perhaps not the knowledge level of knowledge, but a level of knowledge, is always going to be a good thing, because there's going to come a time when the taxi drivers will need to know, you know, little alleyways, or they will need to know West London from East London, but at the same time, and actually saying that, a lot of people have complained that Uber drivers don't know where they're going, and they've had to direct them a lot of the time, which they find quite irritating.
Well, this morning, and I mean this quite literally, I put a Dyson in an Uber and sent it to Bromley, which is the other side of London from Ealing, where I live.
Well, I think this is, again, part of the problem. You know, we are looking at an industry here where Uber has come in and provides Londoners actually with services that they really genuinely need. You know, being able to summon a taxi in an obscure part of London is not necessarily that easy, and hasn't been that easy up until now. And obviously the competitive pricing is a difficulty for the taxi drivers, and they've struggled to compete with that. But in order to be able to provide Londoners with the services that they need, and rather than sort of something that's happened to me a few times, and I've tried to get a black cab in the centre of London, is they've said, no, sorry love, we're not going there, and that's that. Whereas I've never got into an Uber and said, oh, I'm going here, and had somebody tell me, oh no, that's not happening. And you know, I think payment options like being able to pay by Oyster and being able to access a black cab when you need one, I think there's got to be some more emphasis from within in helping the black taxi drivers innovate.
Well, Apple Pay will be arriving in London in a matter of weeks. Well, I say London, the whole of the UK, in a matter of weeks. And my new rule is, if I can't book and pay for a taxi using only my wrist, you are getting none of the money.
I would say that that is a fair assessment. And, you know, we are moving towards that. There's no question about it. You and I, Nate, we're innovators. Well, not innovators, but we're early adopters in this.
Well, you can read Katie's story on wire.co.uk. If you search Boris Uber, I'm sure it is there.
Thank you for having me, Nate.
Well, coming up in just a few moments, we are going to jump into a very interesting feature. Now, this is a little bit different for text message this week. We're going to talk about role play. Now, this is not the stuff that you do horizontally in, or indeed in any position, I'm not here to judge, with your loved ones. No, this is to do with gaming, fantasy characters, and whatnot. Now, why are we talking about this on a grown-up podcast? Well, there's very good reason, and it involves virtual reality, and it involves modern video gaming trends. And I thought it is high time that we introduce everyone to what's going on in this rather unusual and growing subculture of video gaming. Don't touch that knob. That was a radio pun. I wasn't being filthy. Not everyone in the world is as beautiful as you, dear listener, and not everyone knows how to download a podcast. That's why I'm encouraging you to bring someone you know into the podcasting world by telling them about this show and which app you use to listen to it. You'll be helping not only me in text message, but all podcasters who often need word of mouth more than money to help promote their work. Thanks for listening, and hopefully, thanks for the review and the help spreading the word. Or if you want to be on the show, send your comments about this episode or any other tech topic, podcast@natelangson.com. To many, if not most adults, the term roleplay probably invokes mental images of a bedroom, costumes, and a lovely bottle of wine. In the world of video games, roleplay, or RP, may still involve that. But there'll be virtual costumes and characters you've written your own backstory for, and wine in a tavern that serves as a hub for other roleplayers to meet. Fantasy make-believe and live, scripted or unscripted fanfiction in action. It's been taking place for years, decades in fact, if we broaden things to include more than just video games. But the advent of virtual reality and devices like the Oculus Rift are getting some role players very excited indeed. It's something that fascinates me, and indeed I'm myself finding myself increasingly involved in it. So I wanted to dig a little under the surface with a frequent video game role player and technology fan to find out what defines RP and how it's evolving as a culture.
Roleplay in its traditional sense it's fundamentally simple, right? You are in the role of a character.
This is Knight's Knight, a role player, fantasy writer, and frequenter of RP events within the Elder Scrolls Online.
Of a character, or you're in kind of like in your head, imagination wise, like say on a table, Dungeons and Dragons, playing out a story based upon a character that you've created, kind of like on paper. That's fundamentally the simplest form I can think of. It's like you are in the role of a character and you are playing those actions out.
And it's sort of the adult's equivalent of what we do as kids, right? Where you are, it's kind of make-believe, and your group of friends as children are sort of imagining themselves in these scenarios. It's like that, but in a grown-up adult setting.
Correct, yeah. It's like you've been doing it basically forever, even if you're not even aware of it. I like to think everyone is a fan of roleplay because everyone has done it. You know, whether it's two adults in a bedroom or on computer or even like back in the day when everything was just kind of like in the forums, you know, text to speak. You're not text to speak, but you know. I'm just in text.
Yeah. And it's a lot about the conversation. If you've got somebody who believes they are a character in a particular world and you believe you are a character in a particular world and you're both familiar with that world's background or lore or history or stories, then it becomes very interesting for you to be able to make up a conversation between those two characters. So that brings us on to sort of the bulk of what I wanted to talk about today, which is how this is evolving with video games, and later on in the conversation we'll talk about virtual reality and things like that. But I wondered if you could give us an explanation of how these sorts of scenarios translate into modern video games, particularly obviously with massively multiplayer online role-playing games that people heard of, like Elder Scrolls Online, World of Warcraft, things like that. the games are known for being story-based, but between non-player characters, NPCs and battles and things like that, it's less known that there's an entire cultural product, if you like, that exists within these games of just people using the games themselves as a fantasy background to role play with other people in those worlds. I wondered if you could explain a little bit about how that works.
Okay, well, first, I like to think as us role players as like the ideal consumer for game developers, because we kind of create your own content, right? When you're a role player in a game, you are taking, basically, you are writing the story for yourself, right? You're taking control of a character. You have molded them. You have named them. You have shaped their backstory. And you set them in this persistent world that is full, like you said, the lore. And there are other people in there. I mean, thousands of other people. And you just kind of like get together and you act out these characters' actions. And it's kind of like a story, right? There's progression, there's character growth, and you act that out in a role play sense with other people via, you know, text. But I mean, you can now see them, right? So not everything's in your head. So you have the graphics engine. You're doing emotes, which are player actions that, like, say, you know, you wave to somebody else, they can see it, or you sit down, or you can even pull out like an Elder Scrolls, a stringed instrument, and play a tune. I mean, there's so much more that you can do than as a traditional roleplay sense, people think Dungeons and Dragons. It's much more visual and immersive, I would like to think, in the modern games.
And the Dungeons and Dragons' background is, you know, it's board-based, and there are tabletop RPGs where it's done with dice, so there's an element of randomness to how some of the characters and stories play out. But I wondered, I mean, there will be people listening who are probably intrigued by the fact that this sort of world of fantasy and make-believe is something that adults and you know, thousands upon thousands of thousands, if not millions of people globally are involved in these things now. They're probably wondering what it is that makes this appealing to grown-ups to do, you know, and maybe you're the best person to answer that as an adult who does this. What is it that attracts you to doing this within a video game environment?
The attractiveness, I guess the way that it attracts me is that I'm not confined to the developer's original idea in their head, right? I can mold my own experience. I don't need to go to point A to point B. I mean, they give you this whole open world, and to me, the attractiveness of that is being really able to mold it to your liking, and just from a point of, I like to write, so you can really get into your creative side and express that.
Yeah. So that brings us on to the core part of what I wanted to talk about today, which is obviously how technology is helping this trend. Well, it's not a trend, it's something that's been around for decades, but this culture develop. It went from board games and pen and paper text-based stuff into video games, and video games have got much more advanced with graphics, and as you say, the worlds are incredibly rich, so that makes it very attractive to be in. But even if with even bigger monitors, better graphics, at the end of the day, there's only so far you can be immersed in a video game when the technology is effectively standing between you. That's changing with virtual reality, with the likes of Oculus Rift, and with some of the other headsets that are coming out. Sony has recently announced one for the PlayStation 4. There's the HTC, there is Valve's involvement. I know this is something you are a massive fan of. I know you have an Oculus Rift. And so how do you think VR is going to take this activity, this passion that people have for role playing into the next level?
Oh, I think it's gonna take it all the way, because I can tell you right now, the experience in the virtual reality headset is like nothing I've ever had before. It is like you're literally there. Like, I try to explain to people what it's like, and I remember just watching YouTube videos, right? And I was like, they're just overreacting. But no, it's like, it is that exciting. You are there and it feels real. And I can totally see this being huge with RPGs and roleplay games. And with the you throw in something called leap motion where you can actually control the hands of a character and the head motion. I mean, you're basically the character at that point. So, I mean, it's going to be totally unreal. And I know there are a few concepts already out there, like I think it's like a 3D chat game where you control an avatar and other people are in there. So it is multiplayer in a sense, but everything's kind of text. And then they have another one like a movie theater, right? So you sit down in a movie theater and other people are in there with you and you can all talk and watch a movie. It's as if you're there and it's like pretty unreal.
And you and I are both very big fans of the game Elder Scrolls Online. This is something that that for me, even if it's not about role play, the attraction of VR when you're trying to be as immersed as you possibly can in a game, this is now something that's feeling much more than a fad. You know, this is something that really could benefit every player of some of these super immersive games. Like, it doesn't have to just be about role play, and I personally find it incredibly exciting to think that this is something that is on the brink of being able to be real, to have a headset and be inside a world like Elder Scrolls.
Well, I'll tell you right now, if VR becomes mainstream, I won't ever play a game on a monitor again, if the game supports it, of course, because it is just that unreal and it's just that awesome.
All right. Well, let's take it as an assumption that there are people listening who had no idea about RP but do like video games, and they're keen to think, how do I get into RP? Where do I start? What's kind of this? Can you give us some tips on how people should find out more about getting involved in video game RP? What should they do first to get started?
First, I would say dip your toes a little bit in roleplay itself. I advise just kind of Google, right? Pull up your Google, type in, forum roleplay. And it'll give you websites that you can go to and join in, kind of like a persistent story, albeit, on a forum. So you're typing everything out. And then once you kind of get the format of how people talk, it's the same as they would talk in the game, except now you have this avatar that you can control with your actions and your speech, and then move on to the game. And then each game will have their own kind of like dedicated websites. So for Elder Scrolls Online, it's tiso-rp.com. You can go there, and it's a whole roleplay community where people can help you out, point you in the right direction to get you in game with the guild or what have you.
Night from the ESO RP podcast. Thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Well, Ian Morris is still with us, and it is time to talk about some of your feedback from last week's show. Now, Ian and I had a bit of a rant about the price of 3D cinema. Not strictly speaking, just about the cost of getting into the theatre, but the fact that once I entered the cinema 1 week or so ago for a 3D showing of Dino Land, or whatever the hell that was, I then had to reverse my course, go out and pay for some damn 3D glasses. Now, I liken this to saying it was like going for a meal and then being charged for the cutlery. And we had an email from Alex Walker, who was one of the few people who emailed in about this. And Alex said, who'd expect to have to buy a laser gun when you go to Laser Quest? What about a helmet when you go karting? Balls for bowling? They're all essential for participating in the entertainment, but you'd never expect to be charged. Now, Alex continues, I assume the reason they don't like the deposit and return model is that people would try and steal or collect up other glasses to return them or something. I think that's crazy, though. They're virtually disposable. Now, he pointing to something that you mentioned also last week, that these glasses cost a very, very small amount of money. So it seems Alex is in agreement with you there, Ian.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a reasonable point I made, I thought. yeah, I mean, it's probably less than 5p, isn't it, in the kind of volumes they're made. So really, they could just suck it up, couldn't they?
Alex actually also pointed out, he asked why I didn't talk about the disaster at Alton Towers, the big crash during the roller coaster segment last week. The reason being that interview was actually planned prior to the accident happening at Alton Towers. And the other thing was that the interview was nothing to do with Alton Towers, and I didn't want to get into a non-technical debate about the roller coaster crash when I was specifically talking to somebody who didn't actually have anything to do with it. I thought better to swerve that whole thing entirely and just talk about roller coasters in general. So a bit of an editorial decision there, and that is why we didn't talk about that. Now, another email has come in from Simon, who also was listening to the conversation about cinema intently by the sounds of it, and he wanted to share his thoughts on 3D cinema. He actually hates the detrimental effect that glasses have on screen brightness and colour. He says his wife and him never see films in 3D now unless maybe they're shot for IMAX. But he says the other issue is the standard of cinemas in general these days, particularly the big change. There's a total lack of respect for the experience. He says, I mentioned the choice of stains at our local cinema. He says, we have our selection of torn chairs, both on the part of the cinema and audience. It's a vicious circle. Cinemas are seen to scam and not care about the customer. Therefore, the audience treat it more like their living room rather than, say, the theatre. And he says, unless there's a film we really want to see big, we wait for Blu-ray. If we split the cost of that between us, we'll have seen the film for cheaper than our local cinema. And if we like it now, we now own it. So I think that that's a fair point, and it's certainly one that I tend to side on as well, which is I'd rather pay the same amount and, you know, own the download or own the Blu-ray in Simon's case than anything else. What's your view? And we didn't actually talk about how much you go to the cinema and what's your preference.
Well, I mean, I've got two kids, so almost never. I mean, it's just very difficult. But because if you factor in the cost of going to the cinema, some snacks, babysitter, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff, it just becomes so unbelievably expensive. It's just not worth it. I would be more inclined probably to go on my own, maybe, you know, to go during the day when it's quiet, because I work at home, so I can, you know, if I fancied taking some time out of my day to do that, I could. But no, I think, to be honest, I've my home cinema is good enough that I don't feel the need particularly to go to the cinema. I do miss it sometimes. There is something about the cinema that's, you know, usually quite good. I do remember once when Scream first came out in the cinemas, it was around Halloween, and we saw it, you know, in a student town with lots of sort of slightly tipsy students, and it was a really good film experience of a sort that, you know, you don't mind too much if it's a bit sort of, if people are making a fuss in a film like that, because it's kind of part of the fun. But whereas the rest of the time, I really like it when people just shut the hell up and let me watch my film and don't look at their phones and don't talk.
I agree. Well, the last note that I wanted to mention briefly here is we had another one come in from Tom, who said, well, firstly, he agreed with previous comments here that we've had here that he doesn't watch anything in 3D because of the main reason being the lenses are dirty and darker, and he spends more time taking them off and on again through the non-3D bits for him to care about that. But funny you should mention price, because I'm slightly envious here of Tom, because he said, I just thought I'd boast that my closest cinema charged £3.95 a ticket on Tuesdays. And he says that there's a supermarket next door, and so he can get his popcorn there. £4 to see a film. Now, if films were £4, I'd probably see three times as many of them.
Yeah. The way cinema pricing works is very weird, though, and you know, it's a difficult thing to get your head around, because a lot of the pricing is tied up with, in the first couple of weeks, all of the money a cinema makes on ticket sales goes directly to the film distributor, so the cinema doesn't make any profit until the first 2 weeks are done, and then it's only then that it starts to get a cut of that film's revenue. It's not as easy to judge the cinemas as you might think, but that said, they don't do themselves any favours by charging £9 squillion for a bag of rubbish popcorn.
podcast@natelangston.com is where you can send your thoughts on other parts of the show. Thank you again to Night's Night, and do check out ESO-RP if you are curious about that side of the podcasting world. Thanks also earlier on, of course, to Katie Collins and my regular co-host, Mr. Ian Morris, for his input too. Do please keep continuing to give us reviews on iTunes. We're over 60 reviews now, over 65 star reviews, which is just amazing. I continue to be eternally grateful for the reviews and the attention that you guys give, and your help in spreading the word about the show. Please tell your friends, your enemies, your colleagues, your loved ones. Hell, go and stand nude in the street and just yell it out and let's see what happens. And let us know what happens. podcast@natelangston.com. Don't injure yourself. Don't put yourself at risk. But everyone loves a naked screamer. Until next week, thank you for listening.
I once went to a cinema and bought so much pick and mix that the girl behind the counter went, "This is going to be really expensive." And I was like, "Yeah, I don't care." And I didn't, but it was really expensive. It was like, I could have got drunk for that kind of money, which, yeah, it's a lot of money. I think it was about 30 quid, actually. It was a massive bag. It lasted weeks. Like, we didn't get through it in the cinema. It was, we brought back with us. And
my business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.